The Sherwin-Williams Summer Sale is here. Get 30% off select paints and stains or 35% off our newest product, Emerald Symmetry, July 17th through the 27th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
The Lifestyle Show, presented by Selena McKenzie.
Now, Ringo Starr was often overshadowed by his former bandmates, of course, the Beatles, but his story was no less remarkable or compelling. Well, the book called Ringo, A Fab Life, it highlights a life so jaw-droppingly eventful that one is left wondering how he also had time to become one of the best musicians on the planet. Here to tell us about the book is author Tom Doyle. Great to have you on the show with us, Tom.
Hi, Selena.
So, yeah, I mean, extraordinary life. There's lots of things he did as well as being in the Beatles, but he was actually brought up in poverty, wasn't he?
Yes, I mean, he was the poorest of the Beatles, basically. You know, a single mum, working all these different jobs, you know, trying to make ends meet and stuff because his dad had walked out when Ringo was about three. And he had a really tough upbringing, actually, Ringo. You know, because by the time he was six, he was actually in a coma. He'd suffered from peritonitis. Yes, he was in a coma for 10 weeks and his mum was told repeatedly that he might die. And then the same thing happens, different illness, TB, in his early teens. And he spends another year in hospital. So, I mean, basically, he didn't go to school, you know. And it's funny, McCartney said something last year, which is the basic anything that Ringo knows is self-taught, quite literally. Poor upbringing, trouble with illness and stuff like that, which makes it all the more remarkable that he embarks upon this incredible life story.
It's incredible, really, because this time yesterday I was interviewing somebody who'd written about Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, and it's a very similar story. He was also self-taught, didn't grow up in the best of households. Maybe that's what makes these people such geniuses.
Well, you know, a bit of hardship in your early years, I mean, I'm sure drives you on. I mean, if you think about John and Paul, I mean, they both lost their mothers as teenagers. It's a rocket fuel, can we call it?
Yeah, indeed. So how did he get into the band and why did he change his name? Because his real name's Richard Starkey.
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, he was quite a flamboyant character, basically, around Liverpool, quite unusually for the time, and he wore lots of rings. So, first of all, people started calling him Rings, then they started calling him Ringo, you know, and, I mean, basically, he was a star drummer, you know, hence the star with two R's. He was playing in this band called Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, who did, you know, summer season at Butlins and all this sort of stuff. And they were a very showy, flamboyant kind of band. And he became like a star drummer. He would sing Boys, which he later sang with the Beatles, as like a solo spot for the drummer and stuff, you know. What's interesting about it, actually, is that Ringo was kind of way more established as a musician in Liverpool and beyond than John and Paul. I mean, the first time that he met them in the summer of 1960 in the basement of the Jacaranda in Liverpool, he just took a look at them and he was like, he said later, you know, we were the professionals. They were just a bunch of scruffs. So, the thing is, the Beatles actually getting Ringo in the band was a bit of a coup for them too, because he was really well known. But then in 1960, they both find themselves in Hamburg and they're basically sharing a stage, you know. So, I mean, the Beatles are alternating with the Hurricanes, you know, to provide this like 12 hours of non-stop music. And that's where they first became friends. And it's interesting as well, you know, because Pete Best, I mean, he gets a rough deal and stuff like that, the original Beatles drummer. But it's a tough one. I mean, I think socially he didn't fit in. Even in Hamburg, apparently, he used to like slope off on his own and stuff and didn't sort of hang out with the others. And then, you know, by 62, he's kind of phoning in sick a lot of the time. And then Brian Epstein actually knocks on Ringo Ringo's door, right? And I've stood outside Ringo's door where he was living at the time. It's a tiny little house. So Brian Epstein goes around there and says, you fancy doing a sort of lunchtime show at the Cavern with the Beatles? And Ringo says, yeah, hold on, I'll put me trousers on and I'll be right down. So it was a very unglamorous beginning to this band, really.
It's, yeah, I can understand. I mean, Pete Best really needed to gel, didn't he? I would imagine in a band like that, you're going to spend like almost 24 hours a day with each other. You've got to be more like family and get on with each other.
Well, it's how bands split up, really, you know, personality differences and stuff like that, you know. I mean, he complimented them in terms of humour and stuff like that, but also musically. I mean, George Harrison said that the first time that Ringo sat in with the band, it was just electric. I mean, you know, Ringo really put the electricity into the Beatles, and they knew from that point that they were up and running.
And how did he cope with the fame? I mean, they were undoubtedly the biggest band in the world, you know, for many years. How did he cope with that sort of fame from his sort of humble beginnings?
Well, actually, if you look at when they first land in America in 64, I mean, Ringo handles the fame beautifully. I mean, he's the one. It's not John and Paul. It's actually Ringo and George who are doing all the wisecracking and stuff at the press conference. So that side of fame he really handled. But there's a chapter in the book called Weirdland, and that's how he described the sort of state that he suddenly found himself in, and it was more the reaction that his immediate family had. I mean, he was sitting at some family do, and somebody knocked the coffee table, and his tea slopped into the saucer, and somebody said, "Oh no, that'll never do for him. We'll have to get another cup and stuff." And he realised that he'd suddenly slipped into this kind of parallel universe. So, I mean, he learned how to cope with it fine, right? He learned how to cope with it fine, but then by about 68. And, you know, they all go off to India. Ringo comes back after 2 weeks, and there is a bit of a divide. And he does an interview with this journalist called Ray Connolly when he gets back in 68, while the others are actually still out there. And he's really kind of down, you know. I mean, he's saying, "I'm not a great drummer," which he is. I mean, he's a superb drummer. He's going, "I'm not a great drummer and I'm not that interested in getting better," and stuff like that. And then he's also sort of hankering after a non-fame life. He's thinking about his pals back in Liverpool, and he says that life seemed to have fewer problems, but maybe it didn't. So I think it was one of those things that, I mean, like anyone, and especially with that white-hot sort of fame that they had, you had to acclimatise to it, but also you must have had a love-hate relationship. But then, yeah, by the time we get to sort of, I would say, Abbey Road's period on, you know, and obviously the band are breaking up, and then Ringo embarks on this whole career of his own. So at that point, he looks entirely comfortable with fame, I would say.
Mm. And he was married twice, the second time to Bond girl Barbara Bach?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, now they met. There's a whole chapter. I mean, I cover all Ringo's 70s films, The Good and the Bad, and mostly The Bad. and they met on set of a film called Caveman, which was a big star and role for him. It was like a big movie. I mean, it's like a, you know, prehistoric romp, basically. But yeah, they met on there. There's one really funny scene where his character has to jump into a fast-moving river to save Barbara Bach's character. And she said later that that was the moment when she thought, "Oh, God, he's great," you know. And she kind of fell in love with him. And, I mean, that was it. You know, after that film, they were a couple. And, I mean, they've never separated since, you know.
They're still together, are they?
Oh, yeah, big style, yeah. I mean, and they're really good for each other as well, you know. I mean, the book also documents the rough times that he had in, particularly in the late 70s and through the 80s, you know, with drugs and drink. And she was involved in that too. And, you know, it was a dangerous sort of mutual enabling relationship for a while. But in 1988, they decided to get clean. They flew away to Mexico, and that was it, you know, and clean ever since. I mean, they're obviously a really close couple, and obviously really suit each other. And it's so funny because I talked to Joe Walsh of the Eagles, and he is Ringo's brother-in-law, which amazes him still. Because it's mad, right? Because he is married to Barbara's sister, Marjorie. So there you go. I mean, you've got this really odd little setup there. Well, from Joe Walsh's perspective, you know, because he says sometimes at a family do, he'll be sitting there and he'll turn around and he'll go, wow, that's Ringo from the Beatles. Right? I mean, it's just, I mean, I could testify to this. It's like, you know, because I've interviewed Ringo and you can be, you know, rocking away and chatting away and stuff like that, and then suddenly he would just turn his head or something and you go, whoa, that's Ringo Starr.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it's strange. I mean, it's strange with someone who's so famous, isn't it? But yeah, the marriage has endured, and I mean, he is obviously, he's clean, he's healthy. I mean, only last year he was on stage in Vegas doing star jumps at the age of 84. So he's pretty keen to prove that he's supple too.
He certainly is. So you've interviewed him. What's he like as a person? Does he seem a really down-to-earth guy?
Yes, I mean, you know, one of the bits that are in the book that I write about the experience of interviewing him, because, I mean, basically, he only ever wants to be interviewed for up to 20 minutes. Up to 20 minutes, and that's it, you're out. But I mean, in these 20-minute interviews, you can sometimes really see lots of different Ringos, you know, so the comedy grump that we all know, or the cheeky chappy that we all know. But also, you know, he's this whole peace and love thing that he says all the time, right, has its roots basically in the time back in India when the Maharishi gave him a mantra,
yeah,
which he uses all the time, you know, so meditation really helps him and he still does it daily and stuff. So I think Ringo's really surprising in lots of ways, and that's why I thought this sort of multifaceted book, which, you know, is sort of episodic or thematic rather than like a straight retelling of his story, that's why I thought it would work so well.
Yeah, you mentioned his film career. Never mind that, I used to love to hear his voice in Thomas the Tank Engine.
Yes. Well, it was quite funny because that was, those were recorded at a time when, let's say, he wasn't sober. And
really?
There's this brilliant bit in the book when he goes on GMTV to promote it, right, with the Reverend who'd written the Thomas the Tank Engine books. And Ringo looks like he's been up all night, being honest with you. I think he might have been even. But he confesses on that programme that they tried to record a couple of Thomas the Tank Engine things where he was sounding a bit rough, let's say, you know, so they had to re-record them, you know. And it's very funny. He's like, hello, it's Uncle Richie here.
Incredible.
So,
am I right, Tom, that he was once a furniture designer?
Yes, well, that's the thing, yeah. I mean, he had this, he started this thing in 69 called ROR, a company, right? Which basically, it was kind of space age furniture, right? And his partner was this guy called Robin Cruikshank. And yeah, it was like he had various different things. You know, it would be like, I mean, look, this is so Ringo, it's so 1970s. You know, there would be like a space age looking silver drinks cabinet with speaking, well, it was more a hi-fi cabinet with space for drinks on the top, you know, so that's drinks and music at the same time. But he was very successful actually in that. And there was lots of different clients, you know, like David Bowie, and, you know, there was lots of different people went to the company. And it wasn't just because he was a Beatle. It was because actually the designs were kind of amazing and innovative. I mean, they're kind of playthings really, right, for the ultra rich. I mean, there was one coffee table that had the grills from Rolls Royces on either end of it. So a really stylish thing, but maybe not in my price bracket, I would imagine.
Yeah, mine neither. Well, I'm great that he found peace and sobriety and he's still rocking. If people want to buy the book, it's called Ringo, A Fab Life, and it's by Tom Doyle, who we're chatting to now. Tom, it's been lovely to chat to you. Thank you for joining us today.
Brilliant. Thank you, Selena.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye.